All right. Welcome back. We got another episode. I'm really excited to be talking with my guy, Quincy.
My guy. That's awesome. I love it.
What books do you have in the background today, Quincy?
So today it is The Patterson Principles of Selling, and then UOU by Dr. Eric Thomas. I'm really curious about the principles of selling because I was once told that I'm a great salesman, and I denied that sort of following. But now it's like it's coming up in everyday life again. So I'm like, oh, I gotta figure this thing out.
Yeah, we're always selling as marketers. That's always like an underrated skill, I think. I think one of the things that, and I'm looking for a book, I'm looking for the name of the book that I'm reading right now. But one of the things that comes up for me a lot is marketers, like the we always think about just AEs and SDRs selling. And we don't think about the sales we make on a daily basis, right? Marketers deal with really big budgets. Sometimes we're spending $500,000, $1 million a month on spend, on creative, on resources. And so to be able to get access to those resources, to be able to get buy-in cross-functionally across all the teams in the entire company, you need to know how to sell. And so I think these books are sometimes a little bit underrated, or the acquisition of these skills are sometimes a little bit underrated. So I'm reading a book now. I'm trying to find the name of it. But tell me what UOU is about, because I love that title.
Yeah. So first of all, I will say that you just gave me the topic for our next podcast episode that I just wrote down in our planning doc. So what's the difference between marketers and sellers? But then, so UOU is it's a principle from Dr. Eric Thomas, where he is talking about like nobody's coming to save you, essentially, right? Like, so you can't expect to have these big grandiose things in life without like putting in the work. And so like at the end of the day, if you look up and you're where you are still and you haven't grown, it was like it's on you. Like, you owe yourself this $1 million, you owe yourself this progress and this growth. So
that's awesome. I love that. My experience there is different people are driven by different things. So I've always been someone who likes the reward system. So early on at CGM, I would set targets for myself, right? Because my wife and I, we have a pretty tight budget. So I'd say, okay, if we get to, you know, X amount in annual revenue or X amount in MRR, you know, I'm going to, you know, splurge on this trip or whatever. And so those rewards along the way have been really useful for me. Less so for my wife. I don't think she's as driven by those kind of mini rewards. The way she kind of recognizes herself and rewards herself is different than me. Mine tend to be things and presents and, you know, things that cost money. So that's interesting. I'm reading Never Split the Difference, which I love. I've read Getting to Yes or something about that. In negotiating. And one of the themes I'm noticing in books recently is I really love when there's a story that goes along with it, right? There's all these like super tactical executional books, and they don't talk about how to use some of these strategies in practice, or there's no underlying theme. So Never Split the Difference kind of follows this guy, Chris Voss, through his career in the FBI as a negotiator and the different situations that led him to form his opinion of how he thinks about negotiation. And this holds true for me. Like, there's a lot of books out there, like, you know, one that comes to mind that's very executional is Million Dollar Consulting. And there's a lot of books about like how to grow $100 million business or hypergrowth or whatever, not hypergrowth. Blitzscaling by Reid Hoffman. There are a lot of books that are really like, you know, executional with some anecdotes of things that have worked. But I think the best book on entrepreneurship out there, even for people not looking to raise VC funding, is The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And for me, for golf, the best book out there for game improvement is Paper Tiger. And it's a story about a 30-year-old who takes the year off to go live in Florida for a year and try to make the PGA Tour. He's like, you know, an average guy, and he goes down there but you find out all the things he did to actually get better at golf. And he was kind of ahead of his time because he was bulking up, which we didn't really start seeing until
Tiger
came on the scene. And this was like slightly post Tiger, but still he was bulking up. He was working on his mental game. Whereas for a long time, I would say up until the last 5 years, golfers have really just to get better, they've gone to the driving range and hit off mats, and those things don't really help your game. So that's really exciting. Awesome. Let's get into it. That was a nice segue. So I wanted to talk today about data triangulation because, we're living in a world of extremes, and people tend to go to one side or the other. They're either web analytics or they're, you know, listen to your customer. And there's no mix of there's no line of like mixing quantitative data with qualitative data. And I just don't think that's right. That's never been the way that I've operated. And 100% of my campaigns have always been online, right? Or sorry, the products that I've sold have always been online. Right. So even going back to Log Me In, where I ran search marketing campaigns for a couple of the products. I ran SEO, and I was kind of in charge of analytics for a while. Probably the person who was looking at analytics the most inside of that company. All the data was never available in the analytics system to truly know what was going on. You would see a bump in direct traffic, or you would see branded search traffic growing over time. And so analytics doesn't tell you why that growth is happening, and you need to go to other sources to kind of understand what's happening in those instances. And so I've always believed in a really powerful balance between qualitative data and quantitative data. I'm not someone who thinks there's one single source of truth. Yeah. I think it's really difficult to understand why consumers make the decisions they're making. You know, economists are kind of scratching their heads right now. Everybody's talking about a recession, but the spending is still there. And so, you know, it's really difficult to understand the consumer and how they make buying decisions. And to say that Google Analytics and the different visits and the pages they visit is going to tell you everything you need to know is crazy. And talking to a consumer and saying, hey, like, how'd you hear about us? What got you interested in us? Also, both are really valuable pieces of data, but no one of those things is going to tell you everything that you need to know.
Well, I was going to say, yeah. So looking at that, I think the pitfalls are, and we've seen it with some of our clients, and I've seen it at companies that I work with, right? Like I worked at a company where marketing, we didn't use data, right? Everything was subjective. Everything was, hey, we were pushing messaging and this is the creative, this is the messaging, and we're not going to pay attention to how it's reacting or like who is doing what, because it was a sales-led sort of organization. Sales team were doing a whole completely different thing, right? And so if somebody were to come to the marketing team at that particular company and ask us, so who do you think our ideal customers are? Like, why are you pushing this message? And we were like, The creative looks fantastic, and we're supposed to be doing a newsletter, right? Like, that's what we're supposed to be doing.
It came down from the top. We're doing a newsletter. Somebody went to a conference. One of our VCs told us, hey, we should be doing this.
Yeah, and I think that's dangerous. And I think it's also just as dangerous to, like, not put context and a face to the data. Like, if you look at particular people as Google click IDs only, right? Like, if you're the analyst and you're just like, hey, I'm just looking at this person and this is how they behave, and you're not looking at things contextually, you can end up putting money somewhere where you don't want to put it, right? Based on just metrics and assumptions like that. And so without, I think that there's definitely a pitfall in, like, going, like you said, too hard on one or the other without, like, not talking full picture, without talking to each other.
Right.
And I think a lot of companies, the marketing and the data team, don't even talk to each other. They're siloed. They're on different sides of the building. They don't even sit by each other.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. You got to get, I think you need to get your sources of truth. And I think data triangulation is about the idea of there's not going to be any one place where we're going to get all our data, but we're going to kind of look at the different data that we have to understand what we think is being most effective. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of go through some of the pluses and minuses of the different platforms and places where you can get data to kind of understand what's going to be most valuable. And I think four that stick out in my mind are, like, the CRM or marketing automation system. Number two is the analytics platform. Number three is your customer. Number four is sales. And I think all of those are incredibly valuable. If we go up to CRM and marketing automation system, those are going to tell you, if you have it set up right, out of the box, CRM marketing automation system are focused on the lead. They're not focused on accounts. So those are going to tell you where your leads come from. If you give it an upgrade, it's going to give you account-based attribution. So you can see a manager came in, filled out a form, started a trial, and then ultimately the decision maker ended up requesting a demo, working with your sales team, and ultimately making the purchase. And that's data Google Analytics can't give you, right? But sometimes the CRM and marketing automation systems tend to focus on the latter part of the journey, so not how your product was initially discovered, because they can't house all of the data if somebody's visiting your site 10 times before they purchase. Most HubSpot, and a lot of people don't get this, HubSpot is typically just looking at the last session somebody had before they converted to give you source attribution there. And so that is kind of a key piece of information. And one of the ways that Google Analytics has the advantage, because they are willing to house that data on users over multiple sessions before they convert, because that is why they are so strong. But in Google Analytics, what you don't get is understanding of, you know, how two visits are connected to each other, right? So that manager comes in, starts the free trial, and then you see a direct visit later on from the economic buyer. That person's requesting a demo. They have no way to show you the connection between those two data points.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so I want to let you get to the importance of the sales and talking to the customer as well. And then I have a question to ask you regarding all of them working together.
All right. Then we have the customer, right? I love the customer. Customer is a great inspiration for kind of understanding what gets people energized. Mm-hmm. It's also a great way for you to kind of get feedback on some of the things that are working, right? But I think the customer is oftentimes going to be biased in their response to what got them to come to your site, right? Because you're typically asking, hey, how did you hear about us? So if they say, if they're the economic buyer and their manager came in and originally signed up, like found you through Google Ads, found you through LinkedIn, found you through whatever, and then passed that over to the economic buyer, the economic buyer is going to say it was a referral. The economic buyer, you know, they're not going to have the whole picture. They're going to tell you how they found out about it. I also have just seen a tendency, because no decision is made on just one touch point. So a lot of times buyers are really focused on one thing that helped them find out about you. And they aren't necessarily thinking about, okay, I heard a radio ad about you about 6 months ago. I didn't do anything because I didn't need your product yet. Then I went to Google. I was looking for a marketing consulting firm, typed that into Google, found your listing. They may still say the radio ad, but at the end of the day, there were multiple touch points along that way, along that journey that would have led them to purchasing. But like if they search for a marketing consulting firm in Google, they heard your radio ad previously, you're also ranking at the top of Google, they click on your result. Part of that goes to the radio ad, but if your result wasn't there, you wouldn't have ultimately gotten the sale.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, I keep hearing like you have very consistent themes. And like when I talk to you offline, the one thing that I'm hearing that you said in multiple conversations before is how important brand recall is. Like, yeah. Because in this instance, brand recall is like super crucial. But then the other key layer is recency too, right? Because if like you have that brand recall, it comes down to a matter of recency when they're in that high intent phase as to like how like recent they saw you or whatever, and they're like, oh snap, yeah, I remember that from the recall, and then now I'm like in market sort of thing.
Yeah So the reason why the like I'm such a big proponent of the brand is the sum of all touch points that a customer has with your product or your company. I came up in through the world of freemium. So one of my first experiences and probably the most seminal experience in my whole kind of experience as a marketer was working at LogMeIn. A lot of their products were freemium. Our goal, it was a great product. Our goal was to get people into the product so they understood the value of it, get them to the aha moment, and then boom, that person was going to go out and get another customer. They were also going to be more likely to remember us in the future to use other product lines that we had. And so, a lot of our focus was bottom of funnel because like we were looking to just get users in, get people to consider our product and then refer out other places, rather than trying to build the brand through like way up awareness work. We were able to kind of be really successful there and build demand through just getting people into the product.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that totally takes me, because I think this is part of the sales component. And this is my earlier question. So then another thread into a lot of things we've talked about on this podcast is the alignment, right? Like, so I think it's super important to have like not only sales and marketing alignment, but like executive alignment, and even building out these, when you're evaluating your tech stack, these sort of buying committees almost, of people who will evaluate the bigger picture, right? Because if we're thinking no single source of truth, everything has to talk to each other. You can't buy marketing automation in a silo, right? You can't buy necessarily a CRM in a silo, because you're going to be in a different room and you're going to come in and be like, hey, we bought this thing. And then we bought this thing. And it's like, well, they don't work together.
Yeah.
So how are we going to pull those
silent buyers too that are critical? That's why like we see, you know, with ABM, SEO is oftentimes a down funnel. It's when they're with ABM, a lot of times SEO is really critical when companies are in conversations with the sales team. And the, you know, I think about when we were looking for customer support software at one of my last companies, we were deciding between Intercom, Zendesk, and I think Salesforce had like force.com or desk.com, something like that. Yeah. And marketing was worried about it from understanding the full customer journey and have making sure all the data integrated well. Sales wanted the data to be really tight with what was going on inside the Salesforce CRM. And the customer support team wanted to make sure that the data was, or that the platform was easy to use and they were going to be able to service people quickly and blah, blah, blah. Obviously, they had the, you know, they were able to drive a lot of the decision-making because yeah. they were the end users at the end of the day. But marketing and sales were both going to Google. They were asking their friends about their experience using Zendesk, using Intercom, using whatever Salesforce like desk.com was. And so that all impacted the buying decision because everybody, like although Zendesk and all those companies were just talking to our head of customer support and maybe mm-hmm. someone else on the team, marketing and sales still had a seat at the table. And so it's really kind of critical to pay attention to that, especially in ABM, because once the decision is made by whatever team it is that's making the purchasing decision, then the other teams start to get pulled in and they start to have a say and they can sway the deals. It's not always, you know, it depends on the software purchase. It depends on the structure of the company. It depends on a lot of things, but it is really important to make sure you're answering those questions and making sure you're getting information, making sure you have content available for all the different people who might be impacted in that decision. But we have 2 minutes, I think. Can you go over?
Yeah.
We won't go too far over, but the final piece is sales, and they have some of the same biases. So sales, I think, is a great way to get this information because they have context.
Yes.
The difficult thing is for them to, for you to get them to actually care enough to enter the data into your CRM about how these users are finding out about it.
Yeah. But,
so they have some of the same biases that the users do, that the end customers do, that when you ask them questions, they're very much self-centered, thinking about how they heard about it. Sales can hear the excitement in somebody's tone. So at Workable, I oftentimes remember the VP of sales coming up to me like pumped up. Hey, John, this company heard about us through this, or this company is talking about our competitor because they just ran a conference, or you get some of the emotion in the decision that you don't get when somebody fills out a form saying how they heard about you. And so I think that can be really, a really, really powerful thing. The biases on same issues that you have when you ask a user how they heard about you. And then with sales too, it's always the last good conversation that they had that they're going to talk about. So it's not, or they'll be really angry. It'll be like, what do we call that? Like the Yelp review syndrome or Google review syndrome, they will have recency bias in saying like, oh, so-and-so is talking about this. And they'll tell you, they won't say, you know, we were talking to American Express and they said they really liked this. They'll say, recently we've been talking to customers and they've been really pumped up about X, Y, and Z. We should be doing more to push that message out to the market. And so there's a lot of recency bias with what they're talking about, and they will generalize it because they would like to get things done and salespeople know how to sell. And so they will generalize it to make you think, you know, the whole world's falling down if you don't do it this one way. But the truth is that you know, you don't get the whole story there. So
I just had a flashback to working at a company where the sales guy's like, hey, I got this idea for a campaign. Let's just run this little campaign.
Yeah. Everybody knows how to be a marketer. It's like, this is what marketing and product people have to deal with. Everybody has suggestions on like what you should do to improve your product. Oh, you know, if you thought about moving this button up here, it would be really cool if we could do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, I sympathize with product for that reason, but same thing with marketing. It's like, oh, why don't we just, you know, my friend's company ran an ad during the Super Bowl. Have we thought about doing that? And everybody has an opinion about what marketing should be doing. And you know, sales loves to kind of say that, whereas it's a little bit tougher. You're not in the conversations to kind of throw it back at sales and be like, you know, you should just say X, Y, and Z on the sales calls and you'd be a lot more successful. So everybody has an opinion about what marketing should be doing. And that also is one of the reasons why these different sources aren't always the best.
Yeah, and I think that even like just to tie that up to go to our final point, like I think that goes back to the siloed issue where a sales guy is like, well, this really worked in this one instance and we should run a campaign against that. Whereas if you're a really like well-oiled machine in this sort of like data like pool or whatever, you can come back and say, well, we all have all these other factors that we have to, and now we'll loop that into our kind of all up picture.
Yeah. One of the interesting companies we heard who did this was pretty regimented with their SDR team and asking that type of stuff. And one of the things they found was a lot of the people coming in who are becoming customers of theirs were previously customers. So I think it was like 30%. And I love this notion of, and it's something we all need to pay attention to, is the second wave of customers. So the first 5 years that you exist as a product, you start to see some of those users come trickling in. But from that point onward, from 5+ years on, you have this second order effect of people who were customers at a company left to go to a new company. And now they're bringing in your software or they're not bringing in your software. But it's an incredibly important data point to pay attention to so you can understand what the second order effects are of you getting into a company. And also, you know, there are marketing strategies you can use to make sure you improve that. Like you and I have a client where that's a big deal. They have like basically a breeding ground of a couple of companies out there that, you know, get everybody inside their company to use that product. Those people tend to stay with those companies for 2 to 4 years. And then they move on in their career and they're bringing that software with them. And you can't just assume they're going to bring it with them. You need to follow them. You need to track the success of that in order to understand what you can do to kind of foster that growth and make sure they're implementing it with their new team. Well, people are leaving their jobs probably, but at this point every year.
Yeah.
No, they're leaving their job every 1.5 to 2 years. And so there's a pretty easy growth mechanic to, you know, that's built in. If people like your product, if they're going to similar companies that could also use your product, that's I don't want to say easy way, but it's one of the simple ways that you can build in 2x growth every two years, right? Now we need to add channels on top of that because we're trying to probably, you know, double every year for most of the people listening to this podcast, at least, if not triple for some of the earlier stage companies. But that, you know, don't underestimate the power of that momentum that comes from those users.
Sweet. I got nothing else. I think this is a great conversation. I must admit, when you first brought the car, I was like, what does he mean by data triangulation? But yeah. I totally think it's super critical, especially in the hyper digital world that we're in, and even more of the dark funnel stuff that's coming in, right? Like, because that's stuff that you're not even able to track. But you can get a better picture, a rougher estimate of that by using full picture thinking, right? Yeah. Like big picture thinking. So,
Yeah. I mean, what we talked about mostly had to do with attribution. There's a lot of ways to use data triangulation, right? We use it for coming up with topics from an SEO perspective in like kind of talking to customers, understanding what the challenges are that they have, looking at the keyword research and then going with your gut. Those are the three that we use from an SEO perspective. And actually at one of my past companies, Workable, our most popular article ever didn't come from, or the highest searched article we had, the number one driver in customers, didn't come from the keyword research. The keyword research would not have shown that this one got a lot of searches. It was talking to the customer. So it's about data triangulation, not just with attribution. It's across the board. You brought up the dark funnel, which is a term. It's a term. It's a term. But I think it's a really smart way of thinking about it. I think the other one that I would, the fifth kind of pillar I would think about with data is using context with Google Analytics, right? So one of our initial customers was Drift. They did a really good job at coming up with promotions on a monthly basis based off of new products that were coming out, events that they had coming, new content, new research, new things that were happening at the company. And they'd see a lift come in when they did those launches of new users. And it was happening on LinkedIn. It was happening in Slack groups, Facebook groups, like they were promoting it across the board. It wasn't necessarily direct clicks coming in, but you could see a bump. So understanding, okay, you know, having the context of all the different campaigns that are going on at the same time, and then paying attention to web analytics and the timing of those campaigns can be critical. I think email is another one that shouts to me, where if you have a big database, like inevitably when we sent out a database to 100,000 users at one of my last companies, we'd see a bump in demo requests. It wasn't people who are necessarily clicking through on the email. A lot of people are just reading the email and then they're coming to your site later on at a later time when they're ready to get more information from you. So,
That's awesome. You just sparked so many ideas with the email thing, and I don't want to derail and continue this conversation longer, but like I think
why don't you write that one down and we'll go deep on it next time.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, cool. Sounds good. We'll talk later.
All right. Bye, buddy. All right, bye.